Okay, so thanks very much. Thanks for the introduction and the invitation. Thanks also for the opportunity to spread viruses between our countries. What I wanted to talk about today is something I've been interested in recently, which is just the very basic question of what can theory teach us about fundamental physics in the absence of data? So building experiments to probe fundamental physics at higher and higher energies is becoming prohibitively difficult. At a certain point, we're just simply not going to have the capacity to experiment at the shortest possible distances at the highest energy scales. And so the question that I want to talk about today is, what can we learn? What tools do we have so that we can keep learning about physics at these scales? So the organization of my talk is basically as follows. So what particles do we expect to see? What interactions might they have, and what else can we say about these theories? All right, so whenever you sort of play this game, you have to start with some assumptions. You have to start with some assumptions about what the universe might look like at these very short distances. And you always run the risk that you could be wrong, that what your intuition based on physics at larger scales is going to break down at these short distances. Nevertheless, this is sort of the name of the game that we play. And so for the sake of the talk today, for the first half of my talk, the basic assumption that I'm going to adopt is that of Poincaré invariance. So I want to say, let's assume that the universe is fundamentally Poincaré invariant. What can we learn about physics at short distances if this is the case? And then hopefully, if I have time for it, for the second part of my talk, I'll switch to de Sitter invariant instead. All right, so part one, what particles? All right, so again, our starting assumption now is Poincaré invariance. As you all know, this is the full symmetry group of special relativity. Poincaré transformations are the ones that leave the invariant, that leave the interval invariant between any two events. So there are 10 such transformations. We have the four momentum, p mu, the three rotations, and the three boosts, which are encapsulated in j mu nu, like so. All right, so this is important because when we want to construct our one particle states, we want to write down states according to their transformations under the Poincaré group. And in particular, we want to give our states labels such that any inertial observer will agree on the labels between these two states. So because of this, we use the two Casimirs of the Poincaré group, this C1, which is constructed out of momentum squared, and C2, which is the Pauli-Lubansky operator squared, which itself is constructed out of the J mu nu and the rho mu. All right, so based on this, it's very straightforward to classify the representations of the Poincaré group into massive and massless representations. So massive representations, we have p squared is equal to m squared. There's a unitarity bound on the value of m squared. It should be strictly positive. And C2, the second Casimir operator, is a combination of the mass and the spin, where spin is constrained to be a positive half integer. All right, in the case of the massless representations, obviously we have p squared is equal to zero. Because m squared is equal to zero, in fact, C2 is always zero for our massless representations. So instead of C2, we categorize our massless representations by the value of J3, which is in fact Lorentz invariant if you have a massless representation. So this is just the helicity of the particle. And this takes on also half integer values, positive or negative. So I'm probably going to be a little bit sloppy with notation in this talk and talk about the spin of massless particles. What I mean often is helicity in this case. All right, so we've classified our one particle states. So we add to this some notion of causality and locality. We're pretty much inevitably led to describing these particles in terms of fields. And we know how to write down fields for the particle states that I've just discussed. So for simplicity for this talk, I'm going to stick to bosonic or integer spin fields, but a lot of what I'm saying goes through for half integer spins as well. All right, so it's straightforward to write down the Lagrangians for the free particles. So we know how to write down, for example, for massless particles, I have here the Lagrangian for the spin zero, phi field, the spin one field, so this is just electromagnetism free, the spin two field, massless spin two, and so forth. And I can do this at every spin. I know how to write down the free Lagrangian for the field. Same thing for the massive fields as well. All we do is we add the appropriate terms that are quadratic in the field and contain no derivatives. And again, we know how to do this for free fields at every spin. All right, however, when we go now and we look at the standard model of particles, what we see is something that's fairly different. We see something that's fairly restricted. We don't see particles of arbitrary spin and arbitrary mass. So when we look at the standard model of particles, we have the matter sector. So the quarks and leptons are spin half particles. These are all massive particles. Spin one particles, the gauge bosons, we have both massive and massless gauge bosons. The Higgs particle is the only known example we have of a fundamental spin zero particle. This is a massive particle. And if I want to go slightly beyond the standard model, I can include the graviton in this picture, which is a massless spin two particle. All right, so this might raise some questions. Can theory tell us anything about why the standard model looks this way? So in particular, you might ask, why don't we see any particles with spin greater than two? Why do we only see one spin zero particle? Why only spin one spin two particle? Why is the spin two particle massless? And probably the most important question, are any of these actually meaningful questions? So this could be something like trying to answer why our solar system has eight planets or nine planets, and you won't find a very profound answer. However, in certain cases, there are in fact very profound theoretical reasons behind these. I should say, feel free to interrupt and ask questions as well. All right, but in order to answer these questions, we have to go beyond the free Lagrangians, and we have to ask what interactions do these theories allow? So we've written down the free theories, and now we want to construct interacting theories. And so I mean by this both self-interactions of the particle or interactions between different types of particles as well. So let's start with a massless case. So I'm starting with a massless case because the interactions of massless particles are in fact remarkably constrained. So what we want to do is we want to take these Lagrangians that we wrote down for the free theory, and we want to add interactions terms. So I want to add, for example, for the spin zero field, I want to add either terms cubic or higher in phi, or I want to add interactions between phi and some other field, and so forth. So for spin one, I'm interested in terms a cubed and higher, and so forth. And I want to know, what can I add to these theories? So the reason why these theories of massless particles are so constrained is that I know when I have Poincaré invariance and masslessness, I'm led inevitably to the notion of gauge invariance. So these Lagrangians that I wrote down, these three theories are all invariant under gauge symmetries. And I have a little asterisk, so that's except for spin zero. So spin zero has an infinite number of shift symmetries. These aren't really gauge symmetries, but for the higher spins, this goes through. All right, so for the spin zero particle, in fact, this is invariant under this infinite tower of shift symmetries. For a spin one particle, we have the usual gauge invariance of electromagnetism. For the spin two particle, this is a linearized version of diffeomorphism invariance that this action is invariant under. And this continues for higher spin. So for all the massless higher spin particles, there's some linear gauge invariance that this theory is invariant under. And the reason why this gauge invariance is important is because it gives us the correct number of degrees of freedom that we would expect from the representations. So for example, the spin, yeah.
Sorry, can you clarify that first symmetry for delta phi? What are those polynomials? I mean.
Oh yeah, sorry. So I'll talk more about this later. But it's, so this is, the C's are constant tensors that are symmetric and traceless in any two of the indices.
Okay.
And that Lagrangian is invariant under that transformation up to a total derivative.
As long as they're symmetric and traceless.
As long as they're symmetric. They're constant symmetric and traceless C's. Yeah. Okay, so we introduced this gauge invariance so we can get the right number of physical propagating degrees of freedom. For example, the vector, the spin one particle, this is a four vector. It has four independent components. But we know that we should only be propagating two physical degrees of freedom. So these are the two usual transverse modes. And it's the gauge invariance that gets us from these four components of A mu down to the two physical degrees of freedom. All right, likewise for the spin two particle, H mu nu is a symmetric 4x4 matrix. It has 10 independent components, but we know that a massless spin two particle should only propagate 2 degrees of freedom. And so it's precisely these gauge and redundancies that get rid of the extra components of H mu nu and get us down to the right number of physical propagating degrees of freedom. All right, so the trick then, if we add interactions, is that we know that the interacting theories must either preserve or extend the gauge symmetries of the free theory. And this is so that the interacting theory still describes the particles that have the right number of propagating degrees of freedom. So the question is, what can I add to both the Lagrangians and potentially also to the gauge symmetries themselves so that I still have these redundancies in the theory that get rid of these extra degrees of freedom? Now, in fact, there's a trivial way that we can do this. So there's a very simple way to write down interacting theories that preserve the symmetries of the free theory, of the linear symmetry. So for example, in the spin zero case, let me, for simplicity, just consider a theory that preserves the constant shift that the free theory was invariant under. I can write down what's basically a field strength for my field. So this x is d mu phi. That field strength itself is invariant under this shift, delta phi equals c. And so therefore, I can add to my Lagrangian any polynomial in x, and that's going to be invariant under this shift symmetry. And so I can write down trivially interactions that preserve the shift symmetry. The same thing is true for spin one. So f mu nu is my field strength, which is itself invariant under the linear gauge symmetry. So I can add to my Lagrangian any polynomial in f, and this is also going to be invariant under the linear gauge symmetry.
So do you mean a polynomial in f squared or f?
Well, so a polynomial in f with appropriate indices contracted always. Yeah, yeah. So you can have f cubed terms as long as you, yeah. For the spin two field, it turns out that the appropriate field strength is the linearized Riemann tensor. So this object with two derivatives, two partial derivatives on acting on h mu nu, this itself is invariant under the linearized version of diffeomorphism invariants. And so if I write down, if I add to my Lagrangian terms that are polynomial in the linearized Riemann tensor with appropriate indices contracted, this is also going to be invariant under this linear gauge symmetry. All right, so in some sense, these are valid interactions. The issue is that for these gauge theories, they always come with higher derivatives. So they always have more derivatives than the free term, which means that they're going to be suppressed at low energies. So they're going to have to come with some scale that suppresses these interactions and which renders them, in fact, irrelevant at low energies. So then the issue becomes the following. So interesting theories are the ones not that preserve the linear symmetry, but ones where the gauge symmetry is extended by the interactions. So if I take the gauge symmetries of the free theories and I extend them, I add to them new terms, and I add to them potentially field-dependent terms, then I can add terms to my Lagrangian that are invariant under these extended gauge symmetries, but still have fewer derivatives and are still relevant at low energies. Sorry, is there water? Is there thank you. Okay, but these extended symmetries have to obey a very simple constraint. And the constraint is simply that the symmetry algebra must close. So said another way, if I perform two successive gauge transformations, the result itself should also be a gauge transformation. All right, a simple analog we know for translations is that if I perform two successive translations, the result itself is a translation. All right, so this seems like an almost trivial constraint, but it turns out that when you apply it to these extended gauge symmetries, it imposes very severe constraints on what the extended gauge symmetry can look like. So in fact, this was done by Wald in 1986. And what you find in the spin one case, so if you start out with just delta A mu is equal to d mu lambda, for a single spin one field, in fact, there's no way of deforming the gauge symmetry in such a way that the symmetry algebra closes. So if you just have a single spin one field, you pretty much have to write down electromagnetism with no self-interactions. If you let yourself have more than one spin field, so if you have a multiplet of spin one fields, then what you find is that Yang-Mills theory, so the theory of strong interactions, and this is the unique deformation, excuse me, of the linear gauge symmetry. You can do the same thing for spin two particles, and what you find in the spin two case is uniquely general relativity. So this is another way of seeing that general relativity is the unique low energy theory of a massless spin two particle. So this is the only way, thank you, of deforming linear gauge symmetry. Thank you. All right, and at higher spin, there are no such non-trivial deformations. So it stops there. All right, so that's the story for self-interactions. You can also ask what happens if you want to couple these free Lagrangians to other particles. And so there we can invoke the Weinberg-Soft theorems from 1964. So what Weinberg did is he considered very general processes where you just have some stuff coming in and other stuff coming out. And at some point in this process, you emit a gauge boson. All right, and it turns out that the dominant diagrams are those in which the gauge boson is coupled to an external leg. So if you take this process, this very generic process, and you couple to, say, a spin 1 particle, so that's your external gauge boson, and you look at this soft limit where the momentum of the gauge boson goes to 0, and you then impose Lorentz invariance on the amplitude, what you find is a constraint that looks like the following. This sum over E sub n is equal to 0, where E sub n is the coupling between the spin 1 gauge boson and the nth external leg. All right, and this sum should be appropriately normalized so that, for example, the E sub n on the ingoing lines have a minus sign, and the E sub n on the outgoing legs have a plus sign. All right, so in fact, all this is telling you is that electric charge is conserved, that the coupling of the spin 1 particle, the sum of the couplings of the spin 1 particle to your external legs has to be equal to the sum of the charges on the ingoing legs. All right, you can repeat the same process for, say, a spin 2 particle. And what you find is the following constraint here. So now G sub n is the coupling between your spin 2 particle and the nth external leg. And P sub n is the momentum of the nth external leg. All right, so this is a linear relationship between all of the momentum in this process. On the other hand, we already have a linear relationship that relates all of the momentum. And that's simply conservation of momentum. So we already know that the sum of all the P sub n should be equal to 0. Again, appropriately weighted with, say, a minus sign for ingoing particles and a plus sign for outgoing particles. So the only way that those two relationships can be satisfied simultaneously is if all the G sub n are equal to each other. All right, so what this is telling you is that your spin 2 particle must couple the same way to the momentum of all of the external legs. So this is just a way of seeing the equivalence principle. Excuse me. All right, and you can keep doing this for higher spin particles. And what you find are these relations that include more and more factors of the momentum. And so when you take this, again, in addition to the constraint that the total momentum must be conserved, what you find is that there's no way to generically to satisfy both of these relations for generic P. And so the G sub n have to be equal to 0 for spin greater than equal to 3. So we see that for spin greater than equal to 3, the couplings, in fact, don't survive at low energies. All right, so just to summarize the state of things for massless particles. So again, our starting point, really the only thing that we assumed here is Poincaré invariance. What we found for spin 0 particles, really there aren't a lot of obstacles in constructing interacting theories. For the higher spin particles, it becomes more constrained. For spin 1, for a single spin 1 particle, we only have electromagnetism. For a multiplet of spin 1 particles, we can write down Yang-Mills type theories, and we see that electric charge is conserved. For spin 2, we only have general relativity, and in fact, we can derive the equivalence principle from these soft theorems. And for spin greater than or equal to 3, we have no non-trivial theories at low energies. And indeed, this is consistent with what we see in the standard model.
So, Weinberg's theorem is based on having these as external states in your Feynman diagram. Is that correct?
Well, so you can show that those are the dominant contributions
to
the whole amplitude. So the assumption is just at some point in the process, you emit one of these gauge bosons. In principle, it could be coming from not an external leg. But the statement is that, so you're basically doing an expansion in energy, and the dominant piece is coming from the case where the gauge boson is coupled to an external line.
So I guess I'm saying that if you don't have external lines of these guys, then is there no problem?
But then you're saying that it doesn't couple to any particle.
Well, no, but like for example, unstable particles, well, I don't actually know for massless particles what it means for them to be unstable, but yeah. So as long as the only, so I guess if I just I state that my theory, these things don't exist in external external states, wouldn't that solve the problem?
But then you're committing to a theory where you don't have gauge bosons as external states.
Yeah. But most of standard amount of particles don't exist as external space.
Well, but here, I mean, here I'm really just talking about gauge bosons or gravitons, or yeah, maybe I don't understand the.
So gauge bosons also don't exist at external states. They all decay to other things.
Ah, but you can observe a photon. I mean, yeah.
I don't observe it as external state.
Is independently. I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. So you can run the same argument for massive particles. So now we don't have this requirement of gauge symmetry. And so you can ask now, what are the rules for constructing interacting theories? All right, so certainly we know in the case of spin zero, we can easily write down interacting theories here. I have just trivially written down a phi to the four type theory. We know that such particles exist in nature, for example, the Higgs boson. Similarly, for spin one particles, we know how to add interactions to these theories. They're not subject to any kind of constraints like symmetry. And indeed, again, these particles do exist in nature, for example, W and Z bosons. It turns out that for spin two particles, the story becomes more complicated. So even though there isn't a gauge symmetry that we have to obey when we're adding interactions, it turns out that we aren't constrained to write down any possible interacting term. So this is a much more difficult theory to construct. And in addition, it's not a particle that seems to exist as a fundamental particle. So let me put an asterisk by this. What do I mean by a fundamental particle? So indeed, we know that interacting massive high-spin particles do, in fact, exist in various theories. So they belong to the QCD spectrum. So there you have a spectrum of high-spin massive states that all have masses of order the QCD scale. In Kaluza-Klein theory, so if I take some gravitational theory in higher dimensions and I compactify, I'll find a tower of massive spin 2 particles. Where the mass is always parametrically related to the inverse compactification scale. And of course, in string theories, we have towers of massive high spin particles whose masses are related to the inverse string scale. Now, what's true in all of these theories is that if I'm really just interested in a single massive spin 2 particle, then there's no parametric gap in the spectrum between that particle and all of the other particles in my theory. So all of the particles, all of these high spin particles always appear in some tower, and they all have parametrically comparably the same mass. So the question that I'm really interested in is the following. So the question is, can the spectrum look like this? Can I write down a theory where I have some gap leading up to the mass, so some small m here, and then again a parametrically large gap between that massive state and the next massive state in my theory? So said another way, can I construct a theory where the cutoff is much greater than the mass of the particle so that there's some consistent regime in which I can really treat this as an isolated massive spinning particle? So we know how to do this for spin zero particles. A pseudo-Goldstone boson is a good example of this. For spin one particles, in fact, this is what the Higgs mechanism achieves. And the question is, can we do this for particles of spin two and higher? Can I write down a theory of a massive spin two particle where the cutoff is parametrically larger than the mass of the particle that I'm interested in? All right, so how can we construct such a theory? So we're starting with the massive spin two, and we're starting with the free theory. So here I've imported the kinetic term of the massless spin two particle. And now I'm adding to it terms that are quadratic in the field and contain no derivatives. And there are two such terms that I can write down, this h mu nu, h mu nu, and the trace of h squared term. And I'm letting them both appear with different masses. All right, so as we said before, h mu nu has 10 independent components. And we know that for the massless case, it was invariant under this gauge symmetry, under this linearized version of diffeomorphism invariance. And it was this gauge symmetry that got us down to the two physical propagating degrees of freedom. All right, but now by adding this mass term to the Lagrangian, we've explicitly broken this diffeomorphism invariance. And so we're left with extra propagating degrees of freedom. So the question is, how many? So it turns out that if we use the same mass term, or sorry, if we use the same kinetic term that the massless spin two particle had, then we have four on-shell constraints arising from a linearized Bianchi identity. So on-shell, we know that the particle has to obey this constraint equation, which places four constraints on the 10 independent components of h mu nu, and leaves us with six propagating degrees of freedom. On the other hand, we know that a massive graviton should have 2 plus 1, sorry, 2s plus 1, or in other words, 5 propagating degrees of freedom. So said another way, we know that the massless spin 2 particle, this is all in 4 dimensions, propagates the plus or minus 2 helicity modes. The massive graviton, in addition to the plus or minus 2 helicity, propagates the plus or minus 1 helicity and the 0 helicity mode as well. All right, so we have a discrepancy of 1 degree of freedom here. All right, so it turns out that if you tune the mass so that you have this very particular combination of h mu nu minus h squared, then on shell, there's another constraint that appears in your theory. And this is m squared trace of h equal to 0. And so with this particular form of the mass term, you find that you have a theory that propagates the correct number of physical degrees of freedom, so the 5 degrees of freedom. And this is the Fierds-Pauli mass term, and this was written down in 1939. All right, but what we're interested in now is interacting theories. So what we want to know is, can we add self-interactions to this theory, so terms of order h cubed and higher? But now, because we knew we had to tune the mass already at the level of the free theory, so the danger in just adding interaction terms is that they're going to violate this additional constraint. And when they violate this additional constraint, they're going to reintroduce this extra propagating degree of freedom into the theory. And in fact, you can show that this propagating degree of freedom, not only is it bad because it's 1 too many degrees of freedom, but you can show that it always has a wrong sign kinetic term. So it's really a ghostly particle in your theory, and it renders it pathological. So in fact, in 1972, Bolwar and Deser argued that in fact there was no nonlinear theory of massive gravity that avoided this extra pathological degree of freedom. So it became known as the Bolwar-Deser ghost. But it turns out only recently, in the past 10 years, were people able to sort of exploit the loopholes in the Bolwar-Deser argument, and were able to construct a theory of an interacting massive spin 2 particle that propagates 5 degrees of freedom. So the theory looks like this, and I've written in a somewhat compact term. But the point, is that the interaction terms that you can write down are basically every possible way of taking the wedge product of the Veerbein associated with the dynamical metric with a Veerbein associated with some background reference Minkowski metric. So in 4 space-time dimensions, there are 5 such terms that you can write down. One of them is a pure cosmological constant. One of them is non-dynamical. And then another combination of them, in fact, you can absorb the parameters, these beta n that appear in front, into the definition of the mass of the particle. So if you want to count free parameters in this theory, you have the Planck mass, you have the cosmological constant, you have the mass of the graviton, and then there are 2 free parameters that parameterize the non-derivative self-interactions of the massive spin 2 particle. All right, furthermore, you can treat this as a quantum field theory, as an effective field theory, and calculate the cutoff of this effective theory. And it's given by this lambda 3 scale, which is a geometric mean of the Planck mass and the graviton mass. And so as long as your Planck mass is obviously much greater than your graviton mass, there is this parametric separation between the mass of the graviton and the cutoff of this theory. And furthermore, you can show that this hierarchy is stable under quantum corrections. Okay, any questions? All right, so everything that I've done so far in constructing these theories, I've been taking very much a low energy effective field theory approach. So the philosophy of effective field theory is that you pick the particle content of your theory, you pick what symmetries you want it to have, and then you write down every term that's consistent with that particle content and those symmetries, and the coefficients that appear in front of those terms are considered arbitrary to be fixed by observation. However, we know that in fact, not every low energy theory has a consistent high energy completion. So not every low energy theory that we write down is able to be incorporated into a fully UV complete Lorentz invariant theory. So in addition to the constraints that I've already talked about, in fact, there are constraints on low energy theories coming from high energy physics. So one way to see these is to go from the Lagrangian formulation of these theories to an S matrix formulation instead. Now the Lagrangian formulation is useful because certain properties such as causality are manifest in the Lagrangian formulation. On the other hand, as we saw, this means that you have lots of redundancies in your theory that you need to eliminate. On the other hand, if you just focus more on the observables and go to an S matrix formulation, this eliminates the redundancies in the theory, but it means that you have a modified version of causality, or said another way, causality of S matrix elements, we believe is manifested in the analyticity properties of the S matrix elements. So these are the constraints that we impose. All right, so basically by assuming that your S matrix has the correct analytic properties at arbitrarily high energies, you end up being able to impose constraints on the low energy effective theory. So this was done for the case of the massive spin 2 particle. So there's this nice paper by Cliff Chung and Grant Remen where they used analyticity of the S matrix in order to constrain these two free parameters in the theory of the massive spin 2 particle. So these C3 and this D5, these are related to the beta 2 and beta 3 that I wrote down before. And in this plot here, so all of the colored region is forbidden by these analyticity constraints. And the white region in the middle is the region of parameter space for which there could potentially be a consistent Lorentz invariant UV completion of these theories. All right, but there are other constraints coming from high energy physics that we can use to constrain the low energy theory. So another constraint that we've invoked is the absence of superluminality in a certain limit that's known as the Iconal limit. So here we're considering 2-to-2 scattering in the regime where we have a large center of mass energy, but also large impact parameter. So in terms of the Mandelson variables, we're considering a small t over s. And what's interesting about this limit is that it turns out that the most important diagrams are the diagrams of this sort of ladder type form, where you have these external legs, and then you have these rungs exchanging particles in between these two legs. And so what's neat about this is that means that even though you're taking this high energy limit, so even though you're letting the center of mass energy become very large, the only vertices that you need in order to compute this 2-to-2 scattering are the on-shell cubic vertices. So you can remain completely ignorant about what the UV completion of your theory is. You can still go to very high energies. And as long as you know what the low energy on-shell cubic vertices are, you can compute what this 2-to-2 scattering is. All right, so your S matrix element looks something like the following. So your amplitude depends on this phase. This delta of S and B. So again, S is the center of mass energy. B is your impact parameter. And this delta of SB is related to the time delay that a particle experiences in this scattering process. And because we always want propagation to be luminal or subluminal, there's a constraint on this delta that it should always be positive, so that you always get a time delay in these scattering processes. All right, so it turns out that this Iconal scattering regime, you can actually use to calculate a very classical process, which is this the Shapiro time delay. So the Shapiro time delay, you have a black hole, you send a massless particle by the black hole, you can set up a mirror on the other side and let it bounce back again, and you see that in the presence of the black hole, your massless particle experiences a time delay. And this is captured precisely by this Iconal scattering process, where you have, say, a massless particle exchanging gravitons with some scalar background. So this is another way of seeing why, that even though this is a very high energy process, so your center of, your center of mass energy is above the Planck mass, nevertheless, it's equivalent to effectively a classical process, which might give you some intuition of why only these cubic vertices are relevant. And furthermore, we again expect in the Shapiro time delay case that again, you should always only get a delay for a consistent theory and never a time advance. All right, so you can impose this constraint again on this theory of massive spin two particles. So you can look at the scattering of massive spin two particles. You can write down in a model independent way every possible on-shell cubic vertex for a massive spin two particle. So you don't even have to worry about this DRGT massive gravity theory. There's just a finite number of on-shell cubic vertices that you can write down. You can calculate this 2-to-2 scattering and calculate the appropriate phase shift. And then enforce that this phase shift has to be positive. And what you find is that, first of all, it picks out the DRGT theory. And secondly, it puts a constraint on the cubic coupling. And that constraint is that it fixes this parameter C3 to be equal to 1/4. So this blob, the blue blob here, is the allowed region that was coming from these analyticity constraints, whereas the red line is the allowed region coming from this superluminality constraint. And you can see that they intersect on this little line segment. So the statement would be that as long as you pick the parameters of your theory to lie on this little finite line segment, you would expect that you could potentially have both a consistent UV completion of the theory and also that the theory avoids this asymptotic superluminality. All right, so this is a constraint that we imposed on massive spin two scattering. We imposed it as well. In fact, you can use it on massless high-spin particles, and you can use it to rule out cubic couplings of massless high-spin particles. And potentially, you can use it to look for UV completions of general relativity. So in this nice paper by Kamino, Edelstein, Maldacena, and Shaboadov, they looked at general relativity plus higher derivative corrections and showed that with higher derivative corrections, you would expect to see superluminality at scales below the naive cutoff of the theory. And they argue that adding high spin particles to your theory is the only way that you could cure that superluminality. And so you might try and approach this from sort of a ground up point of view and see if you can pick the masses and spins of particles to precisely cure that superluminality and see whether or not you're forced into the string spectrum in that case. All right, so to summarize the state for the massive particles, we see that for spin zero particles, as we would expect, we don't have strong bounds in constructing low energy interacting theories of massive spin zero particles. For spin one particles, we need a Higgs mechanism. Otherwise, there's no problem. The spin two case starts to become more non-trivial. Nevertheless, there seems to still be an allowed region of parameter space. For spin three, massive spin three and higher, well, there's no no-go theorem, but nobody has yet constructed a consistent low-energy interacting theory. And again, this is consistent with what we see in the standard model and gravity. All right, so what else? So how do we go beyond this if we're interested in fundamental building blocks of our universe? So at the beginning of the talk, I started out by assuming Poincaré invariance. I took that to be my starting point to see what the consequences were beyond that. However, we know that to good approximation, our current universe actually looks more like a De Sitter universe than a Poincaré universe. And so you could say, well, let me suppose I start instead with representations of the De Sitter group rather than representations of the Poincaré group. Is there any new physics? Is there anything new that I learn? What do the theoretical constraints look like? Are there any consequences for observation if I adopt this viewpoint instead? All right, so again, this is a maximally symmetric space. It has the same number of isometries as Poincaré. And so we're gonna take this as a starting point for building our representations. All right, so as we said before, in flat space time, we classify particles into massive and massless. The massive particles obey this unitarity bound, m squared greater than zero, somewhat trivial unitarity bound. Whereas for massless particles, we have m squared is strictly equal to zero, and these particles exhibit gauge symmetries. In De Sitter spacetime, the story changes somewhat. So the unitarity bound for massive particles is no longer just m squared greater than zero. It depends on the spin of the particle. And so you have m squared is greater than s times s minus 1 times h squared, where h squared is just the Hubble constant of the De Sitter time or the inverse De Sitter radius. So massive particles have to obey this Higuchi bound. For massless particles, the story is also more complicated. I should say these are effectively massless particles. So what you find is that unitary representations of the de Sitter group include particles that have these following masses that depend on the spin s and also this parameter t that's known as the depth of the field. And t can take on integer values between 0 and s minus 1. So in fact, you can see when t is precisely equal to s minus 1, then m squared is equal to 0. And this is just your usual massless representation. However, when t is not equal to s minus 1, these are in fact massive particles. Nevertheless, they still exhibit gauge symmetry. So these go by the name of partially massless particles. So if I focus on the case of the spin 2 particle, so the spin 2 particle is the lowest spin particle that has a partially massless representation based on this expression here. So if I focus on the spin 2 particle, the allowed region of parameter space looks something like the following. So this is the gray region here. Corresponds to non-unitary regions of parameter space. The white region and the colored lines are the unitary representations. So when m squared is equal to 0, I'm on this blue line here. This is nothing other than general relativity. And I have a theory of a massless spin 2 particle propagating 2 degrees of freedom. When m squared is less than 2h squared, I'm in this gray region up there. And in fact, this is a non-unitary or unstable representation. For m squared greater than 2h squared, I'm in the white region here. This is a massive spin 2 particle. It propagates the expected 5 degrees of freedom. However, precisely on this line, where m squared is equal to 2h squared, so in other words, where this Higuchi bound is saturated, what I find is a massive particle that nevertheless has a scalar gauge symmetry. And this gauge symmetry is responsible for removing the helicity zero mode of the massive spin 2 particle and giving me 4 propagating degrees of freedom. So this is a representation that's special to the de Sitter group. It has no flat space analog. If you were to take the flat space limit of this partially massless particle, it would split into a reducible representation of a massless spin 2 and a massless vector field. All right, so this is the partially massless state. All right, we know how to write down Lagrangians for the free partially massless particle. This is what the scalar gauge symmetry looks like that's responsible for removing the helicity zero mode. And so you might ask the same way that we did for the massless particles, whether or not this theory admits self-interactions. So in fact, we can perform the same argument that Wald did for spin 1 and spin 2 particles. And we can see if there's a non-trivial extension of this scalar gauge symmetry that closes. And it turns out that the answer is no. So if you just brute force adding on higher order terms to the linear gauge symmetries and then enforcing closure, you can show that only by assuming, with the only assumption is that the gauge symmetry has at most 2 derivatives in it, there's no way of deforming the algebra to find something that closes. All right.
Sorry, what about higher derivatives?
Yeah, so I mean, I think nobody has systematically looked at higher derivatives. It's somewhat counterintuitive that if at linear order you could have 2 derivatives, that you only have 2 derivatives at linear order, that the extensions have higher derivatives. It's not ruled out, though. It's possible. Yeah, so there are various no-go theorems. They all make certain assumptions either about the Lagrangian or the symmetries that seem reasonable, but they all have loopholes in them that could be avoided. Yeah.
Sorry. So here, now you're assuming the background is the Sitter, and then you're adding all
this. That's right, yeah. This is a spin 2 particle propagating in a fixed de Sitter background.
So the whole philosophy right now is we fix the background with certain symmetry, and then we add things that...
That's exactly, yeah. So the background is in both the first part of the talk and now, the background is taken to be non-dynamical.
So like in the first one, I know that. That theory allows the Sitter background. We don't know because we have already.
Sorry, say it again.
If like the ones that you wrote down before.
Yeah.
I don't know if they take that as my gravitational theory. Would that allow the Sitter background, or we wouldn't know?
So yeah, I mean, just for this talk, I'm assuming that the background is just fixed, and I'm interested in the representations above on that background. Yeah. I'm not sure if I'm answering your.
That's whether you have these two solutions to massive problems.
Oh, so sorry. So you're saying if you let the.
I take that theory as my theory of gravity.
So there's a difference between the background and then the like classical solution to the spin two particle. So I'm treating these two things as independent of each other. So in fact, I mean, you could potentially have situations where you have a massive spin two particle like in a flat background, but depending on what sources you add, the classical solution for the spin two particle is de Sitter. So these two things don't have to agree with each other.
What's the status of the theory at the moment? Do I have a massive gravity that allows consistently for the Sitter background?
Yeah, you absolutely do. Yeah. Okay, that was the story for the partially massless spin two particles. There's a fairly analogous picture that you can talk about for the higher spin partially massless particles. So again, it's trivial to write down the free Lagrangian, but constructing interacting theories with a finite number of particles is still somewhat elusive. Interestingly, there's something curious going on also with the spin zero representations of de Sitter spacetime. So to motivate these sort of curious spin zero particles, I'm going to go back to flat spacetime for a second, and I'm going to talk about what's going on with this incredibly simple theory of just the free massless scalar in flat spacetime. So as we said before, this free massless scalar is invariant under this infinite tower of what I'm going to call shift symmetries. So these symmetries are polynomials in the coordinate x. And again, the coefficients, these c's, these are just constant tensors that are symmetric under the interchange of any two indices and are traceless under the contraction of any two indices. When you want to add interactions to the massless scalar, there's no way to add interactions that preserve all of this infinite tower of shift symmetries. However, if you pick out different values of k. So if you look at the k equals 0 shift symmetry, the k equals 1 shift symmetry, or the k equals 2 shift symmetry, in fact, there are nonlinear terms that you can add that preserve those subsets, but nothing higher. So just the usual Goldstone boson is an interacting theory that preserves the k equals 0 shift symmetry. Galileons are an example, and DBI scalars are an example of an interacting theory that preserves the k equals 1 shift. And there's this theory known as the special Galilean, which is the only theory that preserves the k equals 2 shift symmetry. Now, this story changes a bit when I go to de Sitter spacetime. If I just write down a free massless scalar in de Sitter, it's no longer invariant under this infinite tower of shift symmetries. What you find instead, though, is that at certain values of the mass, the theory will be invariant under one of these shift symmetries. So we parameterize these different levels by this k here. So I should have written this down. K is an integer that goes from 0 to infinity. So when m sub k has that following form, then the de Sitter, the massive de Sitter scalar, is invariant under the corresponding shift symmetry. And in fact, we found that analogous to the flat spacetime case, we can write down theories that admit interactions for the low values of k, but not for the higher values of k. Now, in flat spacetime, these theories have received a lot of attention recently because they have interesting properties. So they're theories that arise generically when you have spontaneous symmetry breaking. But they enjoy also a lot of interesting properties, such as enhanced soft limits. Some of the theories can be built via recursion relations. So they share a lot of properties with gauge and gravity theories that way. And they also enjoy non-renormalization theorems. And so we can build the analogous theories in de Sitter spacetime. And the question is, do they enjoy a lot of the same special properties that they do in flat spacetime? All right, but there's an issue that arises in the de Sitter case, which you might have noticed, which is that the masses appear to be tachyonic. So in order to get the appropriate symmetry at these integer values, m squared has to be negative. So this might automatically seem to just rule out these theories as non-unitary and therefore not terribly interesting. However, we do have various reasons why we think that these tachyonic scalars still belong to the irreducible unitary representations of the de Sitter group. All right, so one way to see this is the following. So it turns out that there's actually a nice picture that relates these unusual shift symmetric scalar fields to the partially massless representations that I talked about earlier. So let's go back to this spin 2 particle in De Sitter space-time. And let me imagine that I start with a representation that's strictly above the Higuchi bound. So I'm in the white unitary region of the plot. I have some massive spin 2 particle in De Sitter that has m squared greater than 2h squared. So this is just a normal, healthy, massive spin 2 particle. It propagates 5 degrees of freedom. Its Lagrangian is the Lagrangian described by the Fierds-Pauli theory in De Sitter. Now let me do something. Let me take this particle and let me slowly take its mass to the Higuchi bound. So let me lower m squared until it becomes precisely 2h squared. All right, so what you find is the following. So you've started out with this massive scale, this massive spin 2 particle that propagates 5 degrees of freedom. When you take m squared to 2h squared, you have to preserve the number of degrees of freedom that you have. So what's going to happen is that your representation is going to split, and this massive spin 2 particle is going to become a partially massless spin 2 particle plus the extra scalar degree of freedom. So now you have two irreducible representations. You have the partially massless spin 2 propagating 4 degrees of freedom. You have the scalar propagating 1 degree of freedom. And not only that, but the Lagrangian now is the Lagrangian for the partially massless spin 2 plus a scalar that has a tachyonic mass. And in fact, what you find is precisely the k equals 1 soft scalar from the previous representations. Now you can do this for the higher spin, partially massless particles as well. So suppose I start with a representation of a massive spin 3 particle in De Sitter space, and I perform the same exercise. So I take its mass to the Higuchi bound for the spin 3 particle. So again, the representation is going to split into a partially massless spin 3 particle plus a scalar, so I get the right number of degrees of freedom. But now the Lagrangian is going to be that of the partially massless spin 3 plus a scalar which has a tachyonic mass consistent with the k equals 2 soft scalar. And you can show that this works for all of the higher spins. So these scalars that we found, these tachyonic scalars with the shift symmetries, so the level k scalars are nothing other than the decoupled helicity zero modes of the depth t equals 0, spin s equals k plus 1 partially massless particles. So you can imagine that you started from this unitary representation to begin with. You took a limit where you took it to the Higuchi bound. You ended up with a unitary partially massless particle and also one of these tachyonic particles, which we think belong to the unitary exceptional series of the De Sitter group as well. All right, so there's still a lot we want to understand about these tachyonic scalars. So these properties, such as the enhanced soft limits and the constructibility, we still don't understand what the analogs of these things should be in De Sitter space-time. More generally, we know that we have a lot of tools that work in flat space-time for constraining theories and building theories. So properties we discussed like analyticity, but also spinner helicity variables, recursion relations, double copy. We still don't have a good sense of what these things look like in De Sitter space-time, what the analogs are. But hopefully by studying some of these special theories where they have analogs in De Sitter space-time, where we expect there to be some kind of analog of, for example, the enhanced soft limit, or constructibility, we might be able to understand what these kind of constraints should look like in De Sitter. All right, so just to summarize, theory can be very powerful in constraining physics, both physics that we observe and potentially physics that we may never be able to test. There's a variety of possible applications to the tools discussed here, everything from cosmological correlators to understanding theories of massive spinning particles, and to looking for UV completions of general relativity. So let me stop there. Thanks.
Okay, great. So further questions for Rachel? We'll start, I guess, with the students as usual. Student questions.
No pressure.
So you said you think these scalars with negative mass could be still a unitary representation. What's the obstacle in proving that they really are.
Very good. So let me give one more argument why we think they might be, which is not a rigorous proof, and then I'll say what the obstacle is. So another reason why we think that they might be unitary is the fact that if you look at So I know that in late times, the zero mode of a scalar field should go like conformal time to the delta plus with some coefficient plus conformal time to the delta minus plus some coefficient, where for these tachyonic scalars, what you find is that delta plus is equal to, I believe, 3 plus k, whereas delta minus is equal to minus k. So the problem is the negative mode here. So this is telling you at late times, your scalar field would grow unbounded at late times. And in fact, this is indicative of it being tachyonic to begin with. So this is what you would expect for a generic tachyonic scalar. Nevertheless, it turns out that the shift symmetries written in these coordinates have precisely this same behavior at late times. So if you treat the shift symmetry like it's a gauge symmetry, so that two states are actually physically equivalent, you can actually use the shift symmetries to get rid of the growing mode and only be left with modes that are regular at late time. So this is all done in conformal coordinates. If you go to global coordinates instead, in fact, there you can show that there are a finite number of modes that are non-normalizable. But again, you can use the shift symmetries. So it turns out that there's the same number of shift symmetries as non-normalizable modes. And so you can, if you treat the shift symmetries like a gauge symmetry, you can get rid of those non-normalizable modes. Now, the obstacle to actually showing this is that, yeah, so the fields themselves, if you look at their conformal dimension and their spin, they don't seem to belong to the unitary representations of the de Sitter group. But their field strengths do. And so there's a funny thing in de Sitter that even for massless high-spin particles, it's not the weights of the particles themselves, but it's the weights of the field strength that belong to the unitary representations. And so we think the same thing should be true of these scalar fields. The obstruction is basically defining the right norm on these field strengths to show that the norm is positive. So that's what we would like to do to like rigorously claim that these are unitary.
What happens if you have coupling to matter?
For the scalars?
For the scalars or for the gravity, because in the example you embedded the scalar in a massive gravity theory. I would imagine that the coupling to matter of the graviton breaks the symmetry.
Very good. So, we don't think so there's this nice story that links the partially massless representations and these scalars.
Yeah.
We think that you can't, if you start from just a massive, like an interacting massive gravity theory, and then take this limit, you don't actually get a partially massless particle. So in that case, it looks partially, the linear theory looks partially massless, but the interactions destroy the symmetry. So we don't actually, this story is nice for the free theory, but for as soon as you have an interacting massive spin two particle, we don't think you can just continuously take this limit and get an interacting theory of a partially massless particle and the scalar. But we do know how to couple, like if you forget the sort of, that overarching picture, we do know how to couple the scalars by themselves to matter in such a way that it preserves these shift symmetries.
How is that?
So basically, you can construct effectively a metric, so like a g mu nu that's invariant under the shift symmetry. And then as long as you contract, so this depends on phi. So I think, I'm going to forget precisely what this looks like. In certain cases, yeah, you have like a
appropriate number of derivatives of phi.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then if you, as long as you, so you couple to some matter sector using this metric to contract the indices of the matter sector. And then the whole thing is invariant under the shift symmetry.
Any more questions?
One more question just to understand what's going on. So when I write Einstein gravity, all I need to assume is if you know is an invariant.
invariant, and then the theta or Minkowski all of these come out of the solutions that observe in their own particular symmetry. So, but here we are doing, we're assuming we have a particular solution.
No, you. So it's, you're not, I mean, I think background, well, okay, I should, we should be careful with what we call background, yeah. So for the massive spin two particles that I'm talking about, the approach that I'm taking is analogous just to do what to what we do in quantum field theory in flat space. So there we just assume some Minkowski background. Right, and then our particles that are particles that propagate in that Minkowski background. So the theory of a massive spin two particle that I wrote down should be thought of in the same way. There's some fixed, some God-given Minkowski background or de Sitter background, and then you have a spin two particle that propagates on that background. But the solution, to the equations of motion for that particle doesn't necessarily have to agree with what that reference metric is that you stuck into your theory. So a lot of people don't like this fixed metric in the gravitational theories. So one thing that you can do is you can introduce an Einstein-Hilbert term also for this reference metric. And then you get a diffeomorphism invariant theory of two interacting spin two particles. So then it's a bigravity theory. There's no fixed reference metric. You have diff invariance. And then both spin twos are just fixed by their equations of motion. But if you're just talking about one spin two, then you have to have some fixed background.
Okay, so any more questions? Okay, so let's thank Rachel.
Thanks, Lynn.